Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest episode, the latest great adventure from Life on Planet Porky. And I want to say on behalf of myself, and I'm sure Miss Jones will also have something to say, thank you very much indeed for all your wonderful messages that we received during our week summer holiday last week, wishing us well and telling us that we deserved a break. Well, I think that's probably true, Miss Jones, is it not? And can you tell our audience of millions, what exactly did you get up to last week? I hear you were in the Lake District.
Well, I was, and wasn't it nice to be missed, actually?
Yes.
I had some lovely messages from people saying, oh, no, it's not the same without you guys. So here we are back. Yes, I did go up to Cumbria, to Keswick. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was a work mission, but with a very good friend of yours and mine.
That's right.
Who we both used to hang out with in New York years ago.
You bet. I call him Peter the Pieman because that's what we always knew him as in New York. And we're talking here about Peter from Keswick. I've forgotten his surname again.
Peter Myers of Keswick.
Myers of Keswick is his shop. I think it was on Hudson, wasn't it? The street down in Greenwich Village. That's right. Yeah, still going, ongoing business. Peter, I won't say what age he is, but he is a fair old age now, and Peter's still going strong. And what he used to do was, when I was there in the 80s, Peter had run a pub called the Bells of Hell, which you know all about. He told you all about it, didn't he? And that was in Manhattan. That was sort of higher up Manhattan, sort of midtown, higher midtown. But then he took over this butcher shop in Hudson Street, Greenwich Village, which is low rise.
No. We mustn't get the story wrong.
Yeah, go on.
It was not previously a butcher shop. His father had a butcher shop called Myers of Keswick in Keswick itself.
He did, yeah.
And the premises that Peter found in Hudson Street, downtown New York, used to be an Italian restaurant. And he was looking for a place. What happened? His dad came over for an extended holiday and he got very bored very quickly. And to pass the time, he started making little pork pies and sausage rolls and putting them out on the bar free for the customers at about 5 o'clock. So they
invented the Bells of Hell. There's that
in the Bells of Hell.
Yeah.
Yes. And so they invented happy hour, really. So people used to come in, especially for these pies, you see.
Yeah.
So Peter thought, oh, I'm onto something here. You know, there's obviously a taste here for good old English made and baked old fashioned foods.
Yeah.
And decided to open a shop, which he would supply the expat British community in New York with all the goodies they couldn't get in America. So things like Jacob's cream crackers, HP sauce, Branston pickle.
That's right.
And the most amazing one, the best seller of all, is Heinz baked beans.
Yes,
and it still is to this day.
Yeah.
When you think how crazy that is, because the beans are grown in America, they are transported to the UK to be turned into tinned Heinz baked beans.
And then
they're re-imported to America. He always called them the most well-travelled beans on the planet.
Yes, that's right. You're absolutely right. Because, of course, it's based in Philadelphia, Heinz, I think, isn't it? The global company. I think it's based in Philadelphia. And I used to know the boss. He was a former Irish rugby player called Tony O'Reilly, okay? And he rose through the ranks of Heinz because rugby players often are businessmen and doctors and all that kind of stuff. He was a businessman. He worked over in America. He had all the Irish connections and he became the boss of Heinz. And I went and saw him once in Philadelphia and he told me the story of the baked beans, the one that you've just told me. They grew them all in America, they sent him to England, and then expats in England and back. I mean, Peter used to sometimes come up to the pub when his business was well developed and he'd be on edge. And I'd say, what's the problem, Pete? He said, I've got a container coming in today across the Atlantic with all the Branston pickle and the beans and everything else he imported. And if it was a day late, he was letting down all his expat customers, including people like Keith Richards and Naomi Campbell. He had a fun, wonderful business, didn't he?
Oh, he did. And when Princess Diana used to stay at the Carlisle Hotel, he would deliver hampers of foods that Princess Diana particularly wanted to the Carlisle. And he did cater the Stones on a couple of tours. Mm. He was also sending goodies all over America to British people living in the States.
Yes.
So a fantastic business. And his daughter Jenny is running it these days.
Right.
And Peter's back home in Keswick, where he began.
Well, he's a Keswick boy, and he is literally a butcher from Keswick, isn't he? When he made it big in America, he made it very big as well. He was a huge part of the the British expat scene. And on a Friday afternoon, when there were 60 English journalists in Costello's on 44th Street in New York, okay, that's how many English journalists we had in New York in those days. 60 of us would get together Friday afternoon if you weren't out of town, it was the end of the week and all that. And Peter would cycle up from Hudson Street. And as you know, Leanne, going from south to north in Manhattan is uphill. But Peter is a lithe fella because he comes from the Felds, if you know what I mean, the Lake District. He used to walk up and down hills since he was a teenager. And he's a wiry, tough individual. And he'd cycle up on his bike with a rucksack on his back with 30 pork pies. And first come, first served, you could buy a couple of these pork pies, take them home that night. Nobody ever went out for dinner on a Friday night in Manhattan. Honest to God, if you were English, you just went back with your pals and ate Peter's pork pies. Absolutely wonderful.
Sex and drugs and sausage rolls.
Sex and drugs and sausage rolls, absolutely right. But anyway, I'm delighted you caught up with him. He would have had a few good stories to tell about a lot of influential people in New York who used to go there, including the Stones and everybody else. And so I'm delighted. And I'll be touching base with him in the next couple of days, and I'm delighted he's well. Now, whilst we've been away, of course, Miss Jones, plenty has happened. There's been G7 and there's been Carrie starring on the world stage, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I want to talk to you about a more imminent and very, very serious story, and that is the collapse of footballer Christian Eriksen on the pitch in the opening game of Euro 2020, and momentarily, and I use that word very advisedly, his heart stopped and he'd gone and was brought back to life. It's an amazing story, and one that really, really captured the emotion, the emotions of people around the world.
It was horrifying. Did you watch it?
I didn't, actually. I didn't
yeah,
watch
it. I saw it. I was watching it with my mother.
Right.
And suddenly, one of the news reports said, oh, there'd been an accident. And my mother and I looked at each other and said, well, no, there was no accident. Nobody was near him. He just fell to the ground.
Yes.
And people thought maybe he'd had a stroke, a heart attack, whatever else. He's only 29.
Yes.
So it does appear now, from what they're telling us today, that his heart did stop for a moment there.
Yes. Yes, it's horrifying, isn't the thing like that? Do you remember Glenn Hoddle? It happened to Glenn Hoddle in a TV studio. And on both occasions, the lives of Glenn Hoddle and Christian Eriksen were saved by the fact that there was somebody within the immediate vicinity who knew how to operate, what do you call it, when you compress the heart and all that.
CPR,
thank you very much indeed. It happened in Glenn Hoddle's case, because one of the cameramen had been trained in it. He was a member of some local, I don't know what it was, St. John's Ambulance Brigade or something like that. So, and he brought, and Glenn says he brought him back to life, saved his life. And exactly the same thing happened. You'd expect somebody with those sort of skills to be in a football ground, not necessarily a football studio. But nevertheless, heartbreaking, dramatic moment. If I'd have seen it live, I'm not sure how I would feel about it now, because the live pictures must have been everything. I was doing other things, unfortunately, when that game was on. But having seen it since, the debate is, should the game have carried on later or not? And my view is, well, the last image of poor old Christian Eriksen was that he was being stretched off the pitch, but he was awake and live. His eyes were open, oxygen mask. It looked like, and nobody quite knew what had happened to him at that stage. What do you think?
And also, nobody knew whether he was going to make it, because even though his eyes were open, he could have had a second heart attack, if that's what it was.
Yes.
I felt two things. I felt the game should have been abandoned. Of course it should have been. And they made them play it. And of course, Denmark lost, which is a very sad situation. Their minds were not on the football.
Yes.
Their minds were on Christian.
Yeah.
Second thing is that it was horribly loose in terms of coverage. So somebody should have said immediately back to the studio where Gary Lineker could have held the debate and they could have all talked about it. Instead, they kept the cameras on the pitch, on the game, on the stand. There was poor Christian Eriksen's wife having a meltdown, other players in tears, people running around like headless chickens. It was terrible television. And that is what the studio pundits are for, to cover moments like this. So they should have immediately switched back to the studio and let Gary Lineker handle it, but they didn't.
But you say it's terrible television. At the same time, could it not be described as fascinating and amazing television? Because it was a live event. It was, heart-stopping, literally heart-stopping moment. It was a life or death moment. I mean, why is it a sin for people to witness that?
It's prurient. We don't need to watch that, do we? Somebody's heart attack, if that's what it was, a woman's grief, thinking that her husband is dying in front of her very eyes. Yeah. That is, it's car crash television of the worst kind. That would be like watching Princess Diana crash in the car. You know, we don't need to see that. I think it's prurient.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, there's a lot of cross argumentative sort of views about that. I totally agree. The reason, of course, why I'm so interested is that I have exactly the same condition that Christian Eriksen has been diagnosed of, and that is dilated cardiomyopathy. There's several forms of cardiomyopathy. Mine is dilated. There are other forms. You may remember many years ago, although you may be too young, Miss Jones, but Terry Yorath's son died. That is Gabby Yorath's brother, if you see what I mean, playing football.
Or Gabby Logan, as she's known today.
Exactly. Playing football in the back garden, suddenly collapsed and died of exactly the same condition, cardiomyopathy. It's a killer, and two or three people a day die of it in this country. So I am literally genuflecting as I speak to you. I've had it for 17 years now, since I was diagnosed in 2004. And my condition was so serious, I was on the heart transplant list for 7 months waiting for a new heart, because the heart I had was so badly affected by cardiomyopathy, it was never going to work again. And by some miracle, I eventually left the hospital without a heart transplant and have managed to lead a pretty normal life ever since. I really am one of the lucky ones, and I haven't forgotten that.
No, you really are. And this guy, I have to tell you, will never play football again, not professionally.
No, well, he shouldn't play football in any under any conditions whatsoever, because the problem with cardiomyopathy is basically, for the layman's diagnosis, the left-hand chamber of your heart is too big to properly apply pressure to pumping blood through your veins, through the rest of your body. So if it takes just one single missed beat, as it may have done in the case of Christian Eriksen, then you go down like a sack of potatoes, bang, because, you know, it's like an engine that's suddenly deprived of petrol for a second. If you deprive an engine of petrol for just 1 second, the engine stops. And that's what happens to your heart, and that's what happens to your body. It can happen to any cardiomyopathy sufferer at any time. And I'm not playing the violins now and trying to make out that, you know, I'm a brave man and all that, but it was explained to me a long time ago. Bang, it can go at any time. So you then inherit a sort of attitude to life that life is for the living and get on with it, you know?
Yeah, he's 29 years old. He's got two very young children.
Yes, shocking.
He has to put his family first now. And yes. Yeah, you know, it's a shame that this great player will not play again. But frankly, no insurance company is ever going to insure him to play for any club. Inter Milan will not have the funds.
No, of course not. And he shouldn't play football anymore anyway, because he's then putting his life at risk. And as you quite rightly say, he's got a loving family, beautiful wife, kids and all that kind of stuff. And it's all over for him. I have to say that of all the people who live on the world, footballers have gilded existences. And the fact that he's had one up to the age of 29 is some compensation for the fact that he's got to take the rest of his life easier. But of course, I'm not in any way belittling the devastation it will bring to his life. But we all wish him, you know, huge success in getting better and the rest of his future, obviously.
Yeah, definitely. And thank God he didn't die.
Oh, thank God. Absolutely, thank God. It would have been, nobody would have recovered from the holes. In fact, frankly, if he had died and, you know, God forbid he didn't, I think you'd have to have called the tournament off, wouldn't you?
I was about to say the whole Euros would have been scrapped.
Yeah.
Would have had to be. It couldn't. People might have said, oh, well, it has to be played ahead in his honour. No, of course not. You'd have to scrap it.
Yeah.
Any other decision would have been unthinkable.
I totally agree. Just on that, just a reflection on, you know, my working life and all that. When Hillsborough happened and 96 people died, I can't believe that they replayed the semi-final. that was going on then that Liverpool were involved in, which eventually ended up in an FA Cup final between Liverpool and Everton in 1986, I'd have scrapped the competition. How on earth could Graeme Kelly, who was the chief executive of the FA that year, how on earth could he have said, well, OK, that was rather an unfortunate incident. 96 people died, 96 Liverpool fans, and yet they allowed the competition to continue. I think that was horrendous.
It was a terrible decision. And of course, it's always all about the money. But we are much more awake to that kind of thing now. Mm. We are much more sensitive. Thank goodness we are.
Yeah.
And, you know, the human aspect of such a tragedy would have to be put first.
Yes, no, I totally agree. Anyway, to brighter subjects, and I mean really, really brighter subjects. How wonderful was the G7 conference, never mind the politics that are involved, but in terms of the backdrop, in terms of the ambience, in terms of the scenery, in terms of the sense of out air and blue seas and everybody looking happy and refreshed. I thought initially it was a rubbish decision to have it in Carbis Bay down in Cornwall. I thought, well, a tiny little town in Cornwall, it's going to be chaotic. But actually, I think it came over wonderfully well.
Oh dear, you've fallen for all the publicity, haven't you?
I mean,
this is what Gordon Brown called an unforgivable moral failure. The three C's, COVID, climate change and China. No advance was made on any of these problems. You know, millions will go unvaccinated, as he's pointed out. Millions more will die. Climate finance for developed nations was supposed to have reached $100 billion by 2020, but it's fallen far short. And as for the human rights record of China, nothing at all has been done about that. So I think, actually, forget Carrie's hired outfits and that poor little boy of theirs being used as a prop, which I thought was disgusting. I think this was a horrible failure.
Golly, you've become a real eco-warrior since we last talked, Miss Jones, really.
Well, come on. I mean, the G7, or what is it? The group of seven. That's why it's called the G7, isn't it?
Yeah.
This should not have been about some woman's outfits. She's not a politician. She doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. Boris Johnson isn't even our head of state. Her Majesty the Queen is.
Oh, she got involved. The Queen got involved.
Yes, of course, but she wasn't involved in the meetings. Why was Carrie so prominent? Why do we care about what she wore, rented or otherwise? And it shouldn't have been about their bloody baby.
Well,
I'm sorry.
You sound like a non-journalist now, Miss Jones, considering you've made your life out of journalism the last 40 years. For goodness sake, can't you see that it was always going to be the focus on what Carrie was wearing and the little boy has got Boris Johnson's hair? I have to say that I thought it was oversensitive for all the pictures that were used always showed the back of what's the child's name? I've forgotten. Is it Willie or something?
It's Wilfred, isn't it?
Wilfred, that's right. Wilf, yeah.
Yeah.
They only showed the back of Wilfred's head. Why didn't they show the front of Wilfred's head?
This is the point. I mean, just think of the millions it cost in terms of security, travel logistics, all of that kind of thing, to bring that lot together for a few poxy meetings and a load of photo opportunities. Mm. If they really cared about the climate and the cost, they would have done it on Zoom. From their own homes.
Yeah, but it was all so vague.
No, come on, Mike. It was all very, very vague.
What kind of a world conference was that going to be then, doing it on Zoom? I mean, I thought it was spectacular, the location, and I thought lots of came out of it. Joe Biden seems to have gone home pretty happy, and that's a big plus for us because he's the president of the US, obviously. Well, he's obviously gone off to Brussels now, hasn't he, for the other conference, NATO conference. But no, I thought it was great. And I thought Carrie was marvellous, and I'm amazed as a woman of style and presence, you are not, you know, praising Carrie for carrying, you know, the mantle of the first lady of the UK and doing it so well and with such great aplomb.
You are inflating her beyond her non-importance. This was a ridiculous waste of money. It hasn't changed anything. The US-Europe dispute over Trump's trade war with China, for example, that wasn't bridged even a bit. We still have this huge problem between the richest countries that are safe and the poorest countries that are not because of COVID. And this problem will come back to haunt us, the richest countries, because this contagion will spread, as we know it is doing so, mutations and variants and so on. We will all feel the impact of that because those other countries are not being protected. That is what this meeting or this summit should have been about. It should not have been about Carrie's stupid borrowed clothes.
That's so harsh. And you quoted Gordon Brown. Well, Gordon Brown managed to bankrupt this country without COVID, never mind having to deal with a COVID epidemic. So I don't take a lot of what he says very seriously these days.
The facts is not about him, but he's just commenting on the facts.
It's easy to comment when you're not responsible for anything anymore. The greatest politicians in the world are those who don't have to make decisions.
Well, what are you saying, that we shouldn't be commenting on it because we don't make decisions either?
Yeah, we can comment on it, but we don't expect people to act on what we're saying. Gordon Brown still thinks he's running the country, but he isn't. However, let's move on to subjects which
we can agree on.
Well, you might have some agreement on some of it. What about the bravery of the twin who dived into a lake and attacked a crocodile that was killing her sister? I've never read such a dramatic story of sibling love.
Oh, my God. It's one of those stories you can't bear to read because it'll give you nightmares for the rest of time. There was a story in the press a few years ago about a girl who went swimming in a lake or a river somewhere in an African country, and she was eaten alive, and her mother went mad. And I remember reading that story.
By what?
By a crocodile.
A crocodile,
by a crocodile. She was eaten alive. There was no trace of her. And her mother went mad. And I remember reading that story and thinking, I should never read something like this again.
Yeah.
Because I can't unread that. I can't get that out of my head. So I couldn't take on board the details of this one. Mm. It's just too horrific for words. Thank God she survived.
Yeah. No, I read it and I was so shocked. First of all, they had a tourist guide that they paid who wasn't even qualified and didn't even know who was in the lake and all that. But the twin sister realised her other sister was being given the death roll by the crocodile. That apparently is when a crocodile or an alligator turn you over to drown you, and then they bury you in mud at the bottom of the lake and they come back for you later as food, because apparently a body that's been there for a week is much tastier than a fresh body.
Stop it.
But the second sister, the second twin, punched the crocodile on the nose until the first sister was released. I mean, she must have been in a state of utter shock, because no sane person would start having a fight with a crocodile, would they?
It's a bit like when you hear stories about a child trapped underneath a car and a tiny, weeny, 5'3" mother comes along and manages to lift up the car with superhuman strength
to
get the child out from underneath. Something must kick in, some superpower in your brain that allows you, enables you to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think some force or some power must overtake your body. And when it's sibling love or...
I just said that.
Yeah. No, I know that. But you described like the 5'3" woman lifting a truck off their child or something like that. But I think mentally as well as physically, something just happens. But anyway, what do I know about it? Okay, folks, you are listening, of course, to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Miss Jones, of course, the eco-warrior, woman is going to...
Call me Swampy.
Yeah, that's right, Swampy. And she's going to change the world and all that. Let's give her $100 billion here.
In a hunted t-shirt.
Yeah, that's right.
In a hired t-shirt and a pair of combat pants.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah, we'll have you out there on the streets, Miss Jones, and a megaphone and all that kind of stuff, telling the world how to act. Miss Jones, regular listeners to this podcast, Life on Planet Porky, will remember me praising you for your amazing tribute and duty to your children when you organised your own award ceremony in your back garden, because your kids had, or two of them, I think, had qualified and got their diplomas and degrees and everything else. And because of COVID, the parents weren't allowed to do what they normally do, and that's go to huge graduation ceremonies and celebrate and join in. So you did it in your back garden, and it's very touching to hear that you involved all your own family. Now, you know who the Tapau lead singer is, Carol Decker, and she might have been listening to this podcast. I've met Carol in the past, as I've told you, but she did exactly the same thing. But it went wrong, because when she threw the mortarboard in the air, the family dog caught it and ran off with it.
That's very funny. I'm sure she was listening because she's a regular at our Scribblers lunches.
Oh, right.
She's a lovely girl, Carol. She's very down to earth, very funny. She's got perfect pitch as a singer. I think she's long been underestimated, I mean to say, as an artist. She should have had a much bigger career. But it is a nice thing to do to have a back garden graduation. I'm really glad we did ours.
Yeah.
But my son is actually having the real thing at his former college the week after next. Right. So off we all go again. He's got to hire the gowns and special colours. And they all trot across the stage, get their certificates, and then we go out to lunch. Yeah. So it should be a nice day. Yeah.
Oh, lovely. Fantastic. Well, I'm very pleased about that. I think I've told this story before, but I did a show with Carol Decker, Jeremy Vine on 5. We were both on the panel together. And I always talk to my little sister who lives down in Bournemouth, and they run a student letting business. And before I did the show, Jill, you know, said to me, oh, who are you on with tomorrow? You know, and I said, oh, Carol Decker. Oh, and I have told the story before, but Carol Decker's daughter turned up with Carol Decker at my sister's house to pick up the keys to the student house that they were renting. And, of course, Jill fell over backwards. You know, it was Carol Decker who was at the top of the charts for 5 weeks with China in my hand, which was marvellous.
Might even have been China in your hand, I think.
China in your hand, is it? China in my hand, wasn't it? Wasn't that...
I thought it was China in your hand. Oh, maybe I'm wrong.
I think it's my hand, because I tell you what, when I spoke to Carol, I said, oh, I loved your record, you know, China on my mind, because, of course, I always get the lyrics wrong, you know. And she looked at me with a stingy look, and she said, mate, do you mean China in my hand? And I said, yes, of course I do. And it was all about, you know, about song lyrics better than me, but it was all about the fragility of one person leaving their emotions in control of somebody else. And it was like, China in my hand, I could crush you, you know what I mean? All that kind of stuff. But anyway.
Okay, well, I've just looked it up. So to save the 250,000 people writing in and tweeting us to say that we are wrong, the song is called China in Your Hand.
Oh, is it?
And it's about you controlling what happens with it, and whether it's a manageable option. So whether it's a dream job, for example, a home or a lover. When it comes to the reality, the china is broken and can never be fixed if you don't take control of your own scenario.
Oh,
that's what it's
go.
About.
There you go.
There you are.
Absolutely my mistake, of course, but that's not unusual, is it, on this podcast? Now, getting back to Euro 2020, of course, England have got through their first game with a victory over Croatia, 1-0. It's very good, great. Onwards and sideways, so to speak. The big issue, of course, is what is the song for this tournament? What is the song for Euro 2020? The problem is we'll never get over a better song than the Euro 96 song. You know, it's coming home, it's coming home, it's coming, football's coming home. And that's the most famous football song ever. It's been, do you know, it's been top of the charts 4 times, and it's been rewritten 3 times because the Poppy Seeds who sang it? Yeah. Poppy Seeds.
The lightning seeds, I believe.
Yeah, yes. I keep saying
the malapropisms today are just brilliant. Yeah, like, keep them coming.
Yeah, but Badil and Skinner also contributed. I think they wrote the lyrics to it and all that kind of stuff, and they kept rewriting it at successive tournaments that we played in. But I saw a piece just before the tournament started, in which people who worked at the Football Association in the mid-90s were claiming the credit for football's coming home. That was the sort of banner title of the tournament in 96 when it was played in this country. And, of course, we went out in the semi-final to the Germans after the current manager, Gareth Southgate, missed a penalty. You know, something he's been trying to make up for ever since. But I remember it was such a popular song, you know, it's coming home, it's coming home. And, you know, 30 years of hurt. What was it?
Never stop me dreaming. Still gleaming.
That's right.
My father wrote a book called Jules Rimet Still Gleaming, and it was about his 10 years of covering World well, 40 years, actually. Yeah. 40 years of covering 10 World Cups.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. You're right.
I don't think it sort of damned us. The phrase, football's coming home, did damn the England team because it's never come home.
No, it's never come home. You're absolutely right. But I reckon I came up with that expression. I left the FA in 95, then 96, I suddenly found home. But a guy called Darren Venn was interviewed by one of the papers. He was the commercial director at the FA when I was there as director of communications. And he claimed credit for it and said, no, that was mine. I don't think it was. I think it was mine. But, you know, it's one of those things we'll have to get over. Tell me this, Miss Jones. Do you have shopping envy, or do you not like people who have shopping envy? Because I've come across this tale, which I can hardly believe, and that is that people are buying shopping bags. When I mean shopping bags, I mean the holders that you get your clothes in if you shop at Harrods or you know, Louis Vuitton and all that. I mean, even the bags in which you come out of the store with your goods in are incredibly smart and very expensive to produce. And apparently there's a market now for these bags. So people get them on the website, you know, they order and they turn up on Amazon and all that. And then they just put any load of junk in it and start walking around London with a Louis Vuitton bag or a Harrods bag or even a Selfridges bag to make people think they're posh and they've got loads of money. How pathetic is that?
Well, it is. And it has been around for quite a long time, actually. There has always been a thing of going around town with a posh carrier bag. But yeah. I've always thought that's a bit dangerous because surely you're more likely to get mugged if you're carrying a bag that looks as though you've got expensive goods in it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, if you go on eBay or something, which I try never to do, you will see something like the leather box, the red leather sort of gold-etched box that your Cartier watch comes in.
Yeah.
People sell those red leather boxes for hundreds of pounds.
Really?
Without the watch, yeah.
Really? Well,
yes.
Yeah, but
I've got about three of those, so I'll have to dig them out.
No, but you can't walk around with those, can you? I mean, the idea of a shopping bag is that people go shopping, you can walk up and down Oxford Street and all that kind of stuff. But you can't take around the boxes in which your watch once was, can you?
No, you can't, but you can do two things. You can, if you're this kind of person, you could buy your other half a fake Cartier and stick it in the real box, couldn't you?
And also,
there's a woman I know through, I won't say actually how I know her because it'll identify her, but she uses her old Tiffany boxes and buys cheap silver jewellery and puts them in the Tiffany boxes with a white silk ribbon around the outside to make it look as though she bought the gifts at Tiffany.
That's absolutely dreadful. I can't imagine that. But funny enough, you should say that. It's just another light bulb's gone off in my head. The story I read was that not only are they used so people can personally sort of, you know, make them big themselves up when they're out shopping, because so many people talk to each other on Zoom these days, they sort of leave them lying around on shelves in the background. You know what I mean? So your watch boxes would be perfect for that, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I'll have to dig them out. I'll see if I can find them and put them in a little row behind me for the next time I do a Zoom call. How about that?
Absolutely. Our good mate Piers is not going away silently, is he? It's amazing how many times he crops up and pops up and knocks up. Still got his column every week in the Mail on Sunday, and you know, you see him in all sorts of stories all over the place. And the one that most struck my eye since we last spoke, Miss Jones, he went to the Epsom Derby and he ended up in Simon Cowell's box. And, you know, as usual, he was full of fun. He was with his wife, Celia, all that kind of stuff and all that. But amazingly, I read in his column, it's the first time he's ever been to the Epsom Derby. And, you know, for a celebrity of his stature and his standing and his international reputation, I can't believe that. I've been to about 25 derbies, and if I can make it every year and it's available and somebody invites me into their box, I just go. Because where I live, and I'm in that very office now, attached to my domicile, I can walk from here to the main stand at Epsom Racecourse in 10 minutes. And it's almost like my backyard. And I love the Derby. I love those huge racing events. You never see a horse, but you see plenty of champagne and beautiful women dressed in beautiful clothes and the elegance and the wealth and the power. I just love it.
I went to the Derby only once. It was in 1987, I think.
Yep. Was that Commander-in-Chief? I think Commander-in-Chief won that year.
Who knows? I mean, as you say, you never see a horse. But I was invited by my boss, who was Chris Wright, the owner of Christmas Records.
He
had a horse running that day. And that's why we were all invited. All the sort of ex-employees of Chrysalis were gathered to come and witness this great moment, which didn't happen. I have to say it was a bit boring. I didn't much like the Derby as an experience. There's too many people. There's an awful lot of, I have to say, trashy kind of people who drink too much very quickly and then things get out of hand.
Yeah.
And I found it all a bit busy and a bit over the top, to be honest. It's not my cup of tea. I can see why Piers, unless he does the full corporate experience, which he obviously was doing this particular day, I can see why it wouldn't appeal to someone like him.
Except that, you know, Piers flourishes, doesn't he, in high-profile situations usually. But anyway, look, each to his own. It looks to me like Piers is playing a waiting game now, and I, you know, wouldn't dream of talking behind his back. We're not, are we? We're talking on public profile. But it was very interesting that Andrew Neil opened his new TV station within 12 hours earlier of us doing this podcast, okay? And I thought it was very, very enlightening. They ran through all the presenters who were going to be producing, presenting and delivering their main shows, and they offered up their menu of what they're going to do. And most of the feedback has been very good indeed. But Andrew Neil was asked, you know, at one point a couple of days ago in the run-up to his opening, you know, would you go for people like Piers Morgan? And Andrew pointed out, well, a bit difficult to go after Piers at the moment because he's still apparently, allegedly, on a very, very high payment contract from GMB, because although they parted ways, it was, quotes, by mutual consent. So Piers's paycheck continues to roll in. I say good for him.
I say good for him as well. But it is astonishing, given that he walked off the show. So if I would have thought he compromised his contract by doing that.
Yeah.
He walked out. So why are they still
obliged to pay him? I don't think he did. I don't think he did. I think that's a technical thing. He walked off the set for a few minutes, no more than 10, and then was persuaded back by Susanna Reid and other people. But that was great television anyway. He got upset with the Alex, the chap who's a sort of weather guy, then came back. But then he was told that he couldn't appear again on a full-time basis unless he issued an apology to Meghan Markle for what he'd said about his beliefs in what she'd said in the Oprah Winfrey programme. And he declined. He said, I can't apologise. And at that point, he and his employers, ITV, parted company. But his lawyers, I think, made it clear he's still available for work. So I think they just came to what is usually called a Mexican standoff, you know?
Interesting. Mm. Well, I mean, look, he won't be off the screen for terribly long. I know he still does his life stories and his prison programs and whatever else he does. And he's fantastic on television. I've always been a massive fan of
him. Yes, I mean.
I think a lot of people are missing him on their breakfast television show and maybe aren't watching it because he's not there anymore. Because like him or loathe him, you can't ignore him. And he does talk a lot of sense. I do find myself agreeing with him more often than not.
Yes, no, I totally agree. And me as well. Have you ever been to Legoland?
Yes, like many, many times when my children were small.
I was going to say, obviously, it's a place where you take your kids when they're small, and I've never been there. I loved Lego when I was a little kid. But I came across this piece, Kevin Hall, the UK's only Lego-certified professional, and he works as a brick artist for Lego. Can you believe that? Can you believe that your job is a professional Lego bricklayer?
Well, it's rather a limited pursuit, isn't it? I mean, what does this qualify you to do other than to work at Legoland?
Yeah.
Or to give demonstrations or that kind of thing? Yeah. I think I would get pretty bored very quickly.
Well, he doesn't. He keeps building more and more exotic Lego constructions. He says, when I was 5, my mum got me a Lego set for Christmas and I built it just by looking at the picture. I have a photographic memory and even as a kid, if I saw a Lego model, I could recreate it at home without instructions. There are no formal qualifications to become a brick artist. My job is the result of my lifetime passion for Lego. How about that?
Well, I suppose he's in demand. Say they've got a Legoland in Tokyo or in Paris or wherever else. You know, he can spend his days traveling around and creating his magnificent reproductions of famous buildings.
That's right. I loved Lego when I was a kid. You know, I loved it, but my Lego set compared to what they've got today was so basic. You built square buildings on square boards with square roofs, if you see what I mean. I mean, it was never really much more than that. I don't think in my days of Lego, and we're probably going back now, gosh, I hate to admit this, but you're probably going back like 55 years or something. I don't think they even had people.
No, I don't think so either. My brother and I used to make this Lego creation every July. Yeah. It was a Christmas scene. Get this, in July. We were so excited about Christmas that we started work on this thing. It was basically our house. We used to make our family home in Lego.
Yeah.
And then we used to make Father Christmas's sleigh and have it sort of constructed so it looked as though the sleigh was landing on the roof of the house.
Yep.
And then we'd make this scene with loads of cotton wool for snow and
twigs
for trees and presents. The presents were all Lego bricks and everything.
Yeah.
And this was sort of ready by the end of August.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, we were anticipating Christmas. How sad were we?
Yeah, well, not sad at all. I think that's absolutely wonderful. I think the wonder of Christmas is something a child should always embrace, you know, and that's what we missed last Christmas with lockdown, all that kind of stuff. I thought I was going to my sister's for Christmas in Bournemouth before it all crashed, and I bought one of these ridiculous, well, they're not ridiculous, I like them. You know, about this time of the year now, in all the colour magazines, the weekend colour magazines, you'll see a full page of a Christmas tree with a little train running around it. You know what I mean?
Going choo-choo. My mother has one. My mother's got one of those. And it works. The train goes round and round and round the mountain.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when I thought I was going, I thought, we'll make it really special this year. So I ordered it and I got it sent directly to my sister's home in Bournemouth. And it arrived and they were delighted. They said, wonderful. It's going to go on the, you know, the big table in the sort of, you know, main refectory area and all that kind of stuff. And it's all the lights flash. Of course, I never got to see it because we never ended up. But I do think people have got to start thinking about making Christmas this year very special, because we didn't have one last year. And funny enough, I went at my local pub yesterday for a couple of drinks before the England game. The England game is at 2 o'clock. And already the signs are up. Book now for Christmas.
You're joking. No, oh, my goodness.
This is in June. And I'm not talking about, you know, an odd flyer. I'm talking about a really, really big wall advert, book now for Christmas, you know. But of course, as you and I are talking now, Leslie Ann, we know that by the time this podcast is being listened to by our millions of followers and fans, thank you very much indeed, tomorrow, we know that lockdown will be going on for a little while yet, do we not?
Yes, I'm afraid so. And well, we just have to suck it up, as my mom would say. Yeah. And it's for our own good. You know, the numbers are going up. We don't want more people to die. We do have to be careful. And we just have to be patient. So
as you know, I'd like to see lockdown lifted immediately. But if you look at all the opinion polls, more people in this country are happy with an extension of lockdown than are against it. So I'm in the minority. So I have to go with the, you know, I have to go with the flow and say, yeah, if that's what people want. Right.
You're such a democratic man, Michael.
Well, I have to be. I can't start attacking Remainers who won't accept the decision if I don't accept the fact that in the latest poll, it was something like, I think it was about, you know, 56 to 44 or something, are happy to extend lockdown for a month because they want to make sure everybody's got the jab. But there we are. Right, Elvis Jones. So there we are. We are democratic. We are also opinionated. We're also delighted to be back amongst the mix with our followers and listeners. And Miss Jones, be careful in the heat wave, and we'll talk again very soon.
I think this was a horrible failure.
Golly, you've become a real eco-warrior since we last talked, Miss Jones, really.
Well, come on. I mean, the G7, what is it? The group of seven. That's why it's called the G7, isn't it?
Yeah.
This should not have been about some woman's outfits. She's not a politician. She doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. Boris Johnson isn't even our head of state. Her Majesty the Queen is.
Well, she got involved. The Queen got involved.
Yes, of course, but she wasn't involved in the meetings. Why was Carrie so prominent? Why do we care about what she wore, rented or otherwise? And it shouldn't have been about their bloody baby.
You sound like a non-journalist now, Miss Jones, considering you've made your life out of journalism in the last 40 years, for goodness sake.
The song is called China in Your Hand.
Oh, is it?
And it's about you controlling what happens with it and whether it's a manageable option. So whether it's a dream job, for example, home or a lover. When it comes to the reality, the China is broken and can never be fixed if you don't take control of your own scenario. That's what it's about.
There you go.
There you are.
Absolutely my mistake, of course, but that's not unusual, is it, on this podcast? That's right, yeah, we'll have you out there on the streets, Miss Jones, with a megaphone and all that kind of stuff, telling the world how to act.